Hey, it's me, James Stacy, and today we're kicking off a special series of Hodinkee Radio that is tied to the annual Geneva Watch Show, Watches and Wonders. I know it's been a while since you heard from us in this format, but Watches and Wonders kicks off on March 27th, and we're planning to do daily episodes from the show, so stay tuned. To get into the big show spirit, I asked Ben and Danny to jump on a mic and chat about what it's like to go to a show, how these sorts of events have changed over the years, and what we're hoping to see from some of the biggest and most secretive exhibitors at the show. One quick note that this episode includes a bit of adult language, but hey, I've got to be in Geneva any minute now, so let's get to it. All right, Ben, Danny, welcome back to Hodinkee Radio. It's been a little while. I'm thrilled to see you guys on Zoom, and even more thrilled to know that I'll see both of you in Geneva in really just a few days here. How are we doing today?
I'm psyched. I am psyched.
Yeah, I'm just happy to be back on Hodinkee Radio, James, to be honest with you.
Me too. I'm thrilled. It's been a season where it just got so busy that we decided we would take a little pause and decide what the show needs to be. But if the show is anything, it should be like frantic, coffee-fueled kind of reports from the big show in Geneva. So this is kind of our preview episode. You know, I think we probably have a handful of folks on the site these days that maybe only know the show from last year, don't know Baselworld, don't know some of the precursors, and certainly we have some great stories to kind of fill you in on the back catalog of that existence. But Ben, you're one of the few guys I know who's done like several more shows than me within the modern like digital context of watch trade shows. Mm-hmm. And then Danny, you had your first one last year, so I thought that kind of gave us a nice kind of bracketing of the show experience. It's hard to describe because it's so much work when you get there.
Oh, is it ever?
But it is like the best type of work in my mind, because you're solely focused on watches for, you know, 5 days or whatever.
Yes, that's all you care about for the 4 or 5 days or however long you stay. Some people come in for a day, some people stay for like a week and a half. It's really whatever mm-hmm. you want it to be.
You've probably had at least two or three more Baselworlds than I ever did, and of course that's now in all of our past. And you certainly were at SHH for several years before I got there.
Yeah, that was the anti-Canada thing, right? There were no Canadians.
It was they're not. You know what? We're too casual. We don't understand. You know, we're not as luxurious. So you know, and they also didn't like how much carpaccio I ate. So I mean, it all comes down to dollars and cents on that side. But why don't you give those in the audience your perspective on shows and maybe how that's changed in the past? What's got to be 15, 16 years.
Sure, putting it like really colloquially and easy, this is a trade show. Like this is your CES if you're in electronics, this is your Detroit Auto Show if you're in cars, whatever. This is when all the new stuff kind of hits from all the brands. And historically, there were two shows. There was the SIHH, Salon International Horology, said without an accent, I won't even try. That was like the really high-end stuff, the Vacherons, the Audemars Piguets, the Cartiers, basically Richemont kind of centric. And then you had Baselworld, which is the historic kind of trade show. And that... In my day, kind of represented Patek, Rolex, Tudor, Omega, LVMH brands, so Tag Heuer, Bulgari, et cetera. I mean, really, like the big show, and they kind of were at odds with each other in some ways. So the SIHH was really very fancy, if I may say, and the carpaccio that James is referring to is carpaccio served to you for free all day long within the Pal Expo in Geneva,
and they wouldn't cut you off.
Well, they cut James off because it got pretty weird for a minute there.
So you asked for my passport.
Yeah, exactly. So carpaccio, but also sushi. I mean, wine whenever you want, coffee, espresso, whatever, all served to you by like kind of like. I would say like region agnostic, but really beautiful people. And like, where do these people come from? Like, are they Swiss? Are they German? Are they French? Are they like who are they? And where do they come from? Turns out they're just models that they hired to serve you food. But so basically the SIHH took place in early January in Geneva, which is like potentially the worst time to go to Geneva because it's just like slushy and cold, but whatever. And then Baselworld took place in usually the mid to end of March. And that at times you get some really lovely weather and have a beer outside. And Baselworld was really kind of casual and fun. You could kind of do whatever you wanted because there were no kind of preset schedules. The SIHH was like, okay, you are there with those groups, the FHH people. And like, you know, they take that stuff seriously. So you got to be at the dinners, you got to be in a suit and tie. You know, now the two have combined into something called the Watches and Wonders show. Which actually I didn't go to last year solely for personal reasons, all great personal reasons, but I'm excited to see the combined show. But I think it's important to know, like, you know, in the early days of me, the early days of Hodinkee, like digital was really kind of cast aside. I mean, William Messina, who's a friend of the show and longtime friend, you know, he tells me stories of early on when he was at Time Zone, you know, in 2000 and whatever, 2005, six, whatever. And he would be asked to leave booths because he was digital. And then in my early years, when like Hodinkee was starting to become a thing, I was, in fact, the first kind of digital guy or gal to get invited into the booth. But I was told by the largest brands and brands that we all know, including some by publicists that are still at those brands, like, hey, can you just tell my boss if you get asked that you're actually writing for GQ or Esquire or whatever? And I would be like, well, I'm not. They're like, no, we know that. But like, just say that so we don't get in trouble for having you here. And I was like, okay, that doesn't make me feel great about myself, but whatever. And then a few years after that, they would say, actually, like, we want you here. And it would be like us and maybe Ariel from A Blog to Watch or Frank mm-hmm. from Monochrome or Robert Yon. Like, those were the kind of four kind of like digital publications that kind of first were welcomed in.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where, like, I remember taking a picture of like the re-edition or like the revival of the Orange Hand Explorer in the year 2012, 2011, probably even earlier, maybe 2010. And I was actually wearing a Freccione at the time. And it was one of those things where, like, it was the only picture on the internet anywhere of that watch in the metal. Everybody else, the Revolutions, the Watch Times, the whoever, and those are all our friends, like, they were just taking press packs and putting it on their website, if at all. They were really there to publish the print magazine. So, you know, in the early days of digital and blogs, it was up to us and the guys that I mentioned to kind of say, like, hey, okay, here's the information for sure, but like, do you actually want to see what this thing looks like? And so I would carry around a camera and at times a little handy cam and take videos of this stuff. And I think that was probably, those are some of my fondest memories of these trade shows, because like, you were really, really like providing the entire world, the entire digital world, with the only pictures of these things that haven't been like hyper produced by some agency somewhere in Switzerland that makes it look like a cartoon or a caricature of itself, you know? And so it really felt like those were like the most exciting times, because like, you were really doing like service journalism. Like, we weren't selling anything at the time. We were just saying like, hey, here's the stuff. And people got really excited about that. And then of course, as the team grew and you know, life kind of trots along, you know, we became really welcomed and say, actually, would you guys like the first appointment of the week or whatever? And you know, to this day, like, I, you know, because of COVID and because of my daughter, frankly, last year being born, I haven't been in a long time. So I am genuinely excited to get back there, mostly because I'm going to be there with the star of Watches in the Wild, Road Through America, Danny Milton.
Oh, boy.
I know. Oh boy. So like, to walk around with him and just kind of live in his shadow for a week is going to be pretty fun.
I'll let you come along. It'll be a good time.
I bought Danny a whole pack of Sharpies just in case. Make sure he's loaded up for the autographs, no doubt. You know, it's fun to talk about being excited for the show, because as much as it is this sort of like ball of stress that you kind of wade into as the new year starts, it is like the Olympics or like the World Series or whatever. Like, you see all your friends,
Super Bowl, yeah.
Everybody, the Super Bowl, yeah. You see everybody's there. Everybody's on like a similar wavelength because they've dropped everything else in their life to focus on watches and you know, Geneva and that kind of thing. And there really are some like special moments. I remember way back in the day, I guess this would have been 2013, to the morning in Baselworld, waiting in line with everybody else that wanted to get in first so that you could get in front of the Rolex booth and they would open up the kind of shades on the vitrines and you could see what the new models were. And I remember standing there and seeing the Platinum Daytona.
Oh boy.
Which I guess would have been, yeah, 2013.
2013, 10 years ago.
Yeah, which would have been my second time at Baselworld. Everybody was there. You were there. You know, a bunch of our colleagues, both old and new, were there. And just thinking like, well, this is, there's like an actual buzz here. And if you love watches, and I assume if you're listening to this podcast, you do, it's so much fun. It's complicated and the rest of it, but it's so much fun.
That year, our good friend Stevie Pulverant and I have, or he often tells a story about that year, because like, nobody was more excited for 2013 than I was. Like, I love the Daytona to this day. I was wearing one recently, but like, I really loved it back then. Like, the vintage Daytona, double Swiss underline. That was when I was like kind of nerding out about the early stuff. And I was like, man, like, this is the 50th anniversary of the Daytona. Like, imagine what they're going to do for us, thinking that they would give us the steel ceramic or whatever. And they gave us the platinum ice blue dial brown ceramic bezel. Mm-hmm. Which at the time was like a total dog. And I think like that is, it's still to this day, I actually love the watch now, but like those watches, you know, the retail was $75,000. They were trading as low as like $40,000 for a long, long time. They just like, nobody wanted them because look at it, you know?
Right.
And of course, like 2020 hindsight, now they trade for well above retail, but like, that was like, I was genuinely like kind of forlorn. I was upset because I was just like, what? Like, why would Rolex do this to us on the 50th anniversary of Daytona? And then you realize like they do it because they can and because it's fun, you know? And it's like, that's part of their charm is like, they don't need to give you the steel of Daytona. Like they're going to do that on their own time. And that came, you know, 2 or 3 years later.
Yeah.
But it's just like, it's one of those moments that like will always like live in my memory of like, okay, like this is a moment. Having the ceramic bezel on the Daytona, which like sounds so silly if you're talking about any other brand, like putting a ceramic bezel on a watch, like kind of who cares? But in the Rolex world, I mean, that is as big as it gets. And that was a seminal moment for me as a fan of Rolex.
Yeah, I'm curious. Have either of you ever seen, Ben, outside of your normal circles, a casual encounter, have you ever come across one of the 50th anniversary, the Platonas, that people call them?
Oh, for sure. And you know, the other part of my job that you guys don't see and you guys at home certainly don't see is like hanging out with like investor types. And like the Platona is very, very popular in like the rich finance guy set for sure in the New York and LA area. I'm not saying it's cool, but like it is. It's like, you know, if you have it's like a Nautilus or an Aquanaut, it's like that's sure. Another thing that like a rich guy might have. So I've come across them many times. And, you know, the different dial, I mean, this is not a podcast about the Platinum Daytona, although maybe we should do that later. The different dial variations that came out with later, including the Arabic dial, like it ended up becoming like there could be a story about just this reference Platinum Daytona for sure.
Yeah, I knew a collector who I won't, you know, call out here by name, but he had one that he bought, but he kept it in a drawer and opened the drawer and showed it to me in said drawer and then closed the drawer. So it wasn't something
viewing drawer. Particular,
yeah, that he really cared about. And I think I reached out to him later to ask about it, and he was like, yeah, no, I sold it. So I don't know if he sold it because the market went up on it or not, but was definitely one that he wasn't wearing. He was also more of like a vintage collector than modern at the end of the day.
It's one of those things that like I don't want to say you kind of have to have if you're a Daytona guy, but you know, again, like I remember seeing them on this email list that I'm on that I'm sure many of our listeners are on, where they kind of like, it's like kind of gray market or used or whatever watches. And there was one available at $45,000, literally. And it was like new with box, whatever. And this was probably 2017. I'm like, I don't know. Is it worth 45 grand, you know? And now it's probably worth, I don't know, three times that, but you just never know. I mean, like we never could have predicted exactly what happened over the last few years.
Right.
Yeah. I remember years and years and years ago when I lived in Vancouver, I had flown to Toronto probably like around Christmas or something like that, visit some family. And, you know, being a budget minded individual, I took like a bus from the airport to a rental spot, and I'm standing in this like discount. I think it's literally the brand was Discount Rental, something like that. And I'm standing waiting to get a Honda Civic to have for a week or whatever to drive around in the snow. And the other guy in there has one of these Platinum Daytonas on his wrist. And I was like, I'm sure that's fake, right? And he's waiting for a car. I'm waiting for a car. We're just standing there. So I go like, hey, that's an incredible watch. I've never seen one before. His first response was not like, thank you. It was not like, oh, hi. It was, it's real. Do you want to feel it?
It's real.
And I go, oh, so yeah. You've been asked. And so he like just... standing in a rental, you know, location on Dixie Road in Toronto, the guy hands me his Platinum Daytona. He doesn't know me, and he's like, "See how heavy it is? It's the real one. I didn't buy a fake one." I'm like, "Yeah, yeah, it's cool, it's great." And I'm chatting to him. Of course, like it was his rental location, and he owned several other ones in the city as well. I think that was the only time I've seen one like outside of a watch circle where you might expect or wouldn't be surprised to see one.
Right.
But yeah, that was such a special moment, and I feel like if we sat here long enough, I could come up with 20 or 30 others, some of them about like interpersonal hilarity between the Hodinkee team. I joined in for Baselworld in 2018 with the team. And for Baselworld, unlike the Geneva shows, you're not in a hotel, or at least we weren't. We were in kind of shared spaces, Airbnbs, that sort of thing. So you had a lot of like team time, and it was a bit of those like camp moments.
Yeah. So someday we'll write a book about it. And like, there's just so many great stories about like, you know, the random kind of ragtag cast of characters that have come through the Hodinkee ranks, the Jacks of the world, the Cars of the world, Stevie P, of course. It's just goofy. I mean, as you said, it's like summer camp or like, you know, freshman year, like the first week freshman year where it's just like, what is happening? Yeah. A lot of fun stuff. But the trade shows are so exciting because it's just like, I think I'm never better version of myself as a professional than when I'm in Geneva at one of these trade shows. Just like, I just like a switch flips in me and it's like, let's fucking do this thing, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I try to kind of keep to myself and just kind of like live my own personal life as much as possible, you know, 51 of the 52 weeks of the year. But that one other week, it's like, I'm on WhatsApp constantly talking to people. It's just so much fun.
Yeah.
And it also, it becomes a week where like, from an editorial perspective, like you kind of define what's going to happen for the balance of the year. And so it's really important that Hodinkee really does stuff in a different way. And I think we always have done stuff in a different way. And I think we'll see that again this year.
Yeah. And Danny, it was your first one last year. And I actually thought last year was a great show. There, we had a huge turnout in terms of audience. There was no like loss of interest because the pandemic kind of pushed the shows out of the face-to-face realm for some time. What was your, you know, hearing the stories, probably hearing stories like the ones we just told for the last 10 minutes, what was your experience when you actually got there? Like, I felt the magic was there last year for sure.
Yeah, you don't even have time to think about it. You're in it. I mean, because when you walk onto the trade show floor, it starts. You have the appointments immediately. And, you know, I kind of hung around with you a lot for a good portion of it last year.
That's your first mistake, right?
I've learned that in hindsight, but that'll be corrected this year. But even when you're between appointments and you're between seeing watches and we're sitting down and eating carpaccio and editing photos and stories simultaneously, you're literally just grinding the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I remember most is the flight back. Is I unluckily sat next to the sweet older woman who wouldn't stop talking to me on the plane, and I could not have been more tired from everything we had just been through. And it was a daytime flight, and you know, I literally want to fall asleep. And for 4 hours, it took me 4 hours before I had to let her know politely that what I had just done and why I cannot talk to her anymore. I can't wait for this year because of last year. And you're right, there's a magic to it. You see everybody from around the industry, people that you basically interact with only on social media all the time,
or you just know their name from email,
or from email, and you feel like you know them even if you'd never met them in person.
Yeah.
I had a funny thing happen last year. I was celebrating my wedding anniversary while I was there, and I posted something on Instagram that it was my anniversary. And normally you'd get like comments on Instagram, but I was getting them shouted at me across the trade show floor, like happy anniversary from like people like I barely tangentially know. And that kind of thing, it feels good though, because you feel like you're part of something that everybody there is sharing.
And like, because there's such pride taken in the Swiss watch industry from the Swiss perspective, everyone who's there, even if they don't necessarily write about or photograph watches or work for a watch brand, is sort of like part of the vibe.
Yeah.
You enter the Pell Expo and you kind of enter this bubble where like watches take on way more value or importance or fun than they really do in the normal world. And even in the world that we try to build with Hodinkee. And I'd be super curious, like, are there specific brands, like specific meetings you're really pumped for?
I'm going to guess Rolex is important to Danny. That's just a feeling I have.
Just a little bit. I am like unreasonably excited to see what Rolex has up its sleeve this year. Especially coming off of that Daytona conversation we just finished.
Well, especially with the brands like part of their whole appeal being the secrecy, that the reveal is, you know, we finally see the end of the magic trick.
The big one is obviously Rolex. Like that kind of goes without saying, but has to be said. It is the watch industry in so many ways. Like what they do dictate. I mean, like, remember when the Rainbow came out in 2018, and now like there's rainbows on like Mosers and like, you know, like odd things like that. Like, what Rolex does, other people will do over the next half a decade plus. So from like an industry kind of like coverage perspective, which I guess that's what we do, what Rolex does like is super important. And then, of course, like just as a fan, like Rolex is an important brand as a collector. So there's no question that that Rolex is a huge, huge part of the story, no matter what else is going on. Tudor would be another one. You know, as a lover of Tudor, and I know I have at least one other Tudor lover on this call, like that's another one, because it's just like it's Rolex, but like fun.
Yeah.
You know, just like Rolex with like 20% more fun. And the like great personalities behind the brand that we know super well and have historically for a long time. The one that has always meant a lot to me, and granted it's been a few years because of COVID, is Patek. And historically, Hodinkee has had one of the first appointments with Patek year after year to see this stuff. And sometimes we sit with a gentleman there who is, you know, basically one of the technical director as well as some other people. And you really, you are reminded, or I should say, I am reminded of how special Patek Philippe is. And I think it's really, especially in the recent years, it's really easy to just kind of like, oh yeah, they make the Nautilus and the Aquanaut, which are like undoubtedly cool watches. But like they do some bananas stuff all the time, and they don't. They're the Rolex of the high end world. Like they don't shout from the rooftop about all that they're doing, but like they're quietly crushing it all the time. And every appointment that I've had with them over the past 15 years reminds me of that. And I always leave that booth more than almost any other booth wanting something that I just saw, because it's like it is. You know, it's Patek Philippe. It's not a watch. It's something else. And then, you know, again, this will be the first year where it's combined. And it'll be weird for me because like the other brands that I get excited about, like, for example, Omega. I love Omega, as I'm sure many of you know. They won't be there. Audemars Piguet will not be there. You know, so like those guys will be notable absences. But of course, you have in their stead, you have Langenson, who, you know, I just adore, and Cartier, of course. So, I mean, there's Vacheron to some degree. Like, there are lots of things to look forward to. And then, of course, the independents. And I think, like, the fun thing about these shows back in the day, like, way back in the day, was, like, getting a beer with Philippe Dufour and, like, seeing Kari's personal so-and-so that, like, nobody knew he was making. And back then, nobody gave a shit. And that was really fun. And so, you know, it's the combination of seeing, like, the most important introductions from the biggest brands in the world, like a Rolex or Patek, and then just, like, hanging out with your bros, like the Barton, Tim Groenfeld, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, the big brands definitely matter a lot. But I mean, like, it was at Basel World where I met Recep for the first time, you know, and like you meet somebody like that. And it's like, whoa, like this guy is a guy. And 6 years later, here he is. He's like the hottest watchmaker alive, you know. So it's just it's where everything happens. I mean, you just kind of have to be there.
We last year also didn't just stay inside the Palexpo, like we got around Geneva a bit, visited, you know, the guys over at MB&F. Speaking of Recep, went over to his workshop, and you just like hang out. You have a cup of coffee in the middle of the day. So it's great that the Palexpo is out there where the trade show is going on, but you need to get fresh air. Like you just have to, or you won't survive this thing. And being able to hit Old Town and see some of these other folks is really like a highlight and something that I'm looking forward to this year too.
Yeah, and there's a couple, like, I would almost call them theaters of like Swiss watchmaking that exist within. So now we have Madhouse. In the past, we've gone to Mad Gallery. This year, we're going to Madhouse, which I'm quite excited about.
Me too.
To see MB&F stuff. But then you also get to go to like the home of Jorn, which is not a casual place. It's not a tech park or something like that. It's this
amazing.
Beautiful building
yeah.
with the most amazing ceilings I've ever seen. And usually there's a leg of ham, roughly half of my size, that's being carved up. So, you know, I'm around, but your spider senses are tingling for that. And there's an incredible library. He is one of the finest libraries of sort of books about horology and that sort of thing. So there are some experiences that you don't get anywhere else, and they don't have to be, you know, Jorn or MB&F. I'm also really pumped. There's an ancillary show, like more of a public show called Time to Watches. And in there is also where Zinn shows off. So I actually get to see Zinn in my hand. You know, once a year, they're a pretty tough brand to see in person, but they have some pretty cool stuff this year. I'm pretty pumped to see the new T50 line. And then at the show, this is a rare treat for me. Last year, due to COVID restrictions, the Patek meeting was limited to two people. And this year, we aligned several meetings, but I get to go with Ben, which feels like an extra. That's like antique hunting with the right guy.
I didn't know that. I who approved that?
Hey, you made me make the schedule, baby. Yeah,
you made me make.
Yes, it's
schedule.
You and me. So I'm your photographer for that meeting.
Amazing.
Yeah,
amazing.
I'm pumped for all that stuff. It's going to be great. And you always get a good showing from Chopard.
Yeah,
they always have interesting stuff. They still represent the kind of vestigial spine of Basel World. And when you walk from the end, there's like a hard line in the ground of this like white kind of elven palace of Watches and Wonders, and of course it's still Watches and Wonders, but you walk into a slice of old Basel World,
yeah,
and you have Rolex, Tudor, Chopard, and Patek all kind of in a row, and it's great. And yeah, I couldn't be more pumped for Tudor to see what they came up with. Talk about a brand that's been on a run. I remember sitting at a dinner the first year I was ever went to Basel. I was staying in Zurich, took the train in for the day, and then went to a dinner with Tudor, and that's where they showed off the first of the Black Bays. Mm. And I remember thinking like, oh, so this is the kind of direction we're going. This is pretty cool. And then it's they've been on a run since then for sure.
So let's explore that a little bit. I mean, nobody's a bigger fan of Tudor than I am. Like we, you know, with Russell Kelly, you know, we really kind of helped kind of bring them back in the U.S. The product has been so good, but do you feel the same attachment to the brand that you did 5 years ago?
Oh, for me, the attachment's only deeper because I took like 10 years to finally buy one, and I've only had it for a couple months now. I've got the Pelagos 39. I think the brand is like refining their, I hate the term, but like their DNA, their vibe, and they're figuring out where it works, but they still offer a big breadth.
Yeah, I mean, look, I am jaded AF, you know, after being me for 15 years, you know, but like the excitement around Black Bay, Black Bay 58, even Tudor Heritage Chrono, which was, I think, probably over 10 years ago at this point, not available in the U.S. I remember writing a story about them selling an Antiquorum, like the first watches sold in the U.S. You know, those really felt so fresh and so different than anything else in the watch world at that price point, you know, frankly, at any price point. It really felt really, really special. And that was before a lot of the other kind of other brands, you know, the ones you would imagine have started to get into like the heritage stuff. It was before Rolex really started to pay attention to their own heritage from a product perspective. They were always aware of it, obviously. I would say 6 to 10 years ago, I think for Tudor, for me, and again, this is my arc, not anybody else's, was the most exciting brand in the world. And that was just like, that was amazing. And like it was in many ways more exciting to go to a Tudor presentation when Davide was there. And it was just like, it was just energetic. I mean, it was just really magnetic. And I'm not saying the product has gotten worse. It hasn't. It's gotten better. But I just think that like, and it's not their fault. I think it's just the nature of watches today. It's like there's just so many more people in it. Like everything's been done. You really got to push hard to kind of break through the noise. But yeah, those years to me, as I said, 6 to 10 years ago, nobody was doing like Tudor in that period to me was as good as it gets in my opinion. Especially like the Black Bay, the Black Bay 58, like Black Bay 58. Like I think that's a top five watch of all time for me, just in terms of wearability and what it does. Just super special times for me in my vantage point.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I think speaking of the Chronograph Blue, I've got, you know, we've got our Rolex and Tudor prediction posts coming out probably around the same time as this episode, and that was my pick. Was, you know, could we 39 the Chronograph Blue? And I don't even think it necessarily needs it, but it's also not a watch that they're, you know, promoting as kind of one of their flagships these days. It's still on the website, but I don't think it doesn't garner the same kind of attention it did. Yeah, call it 8 to 10 years ago.
The Chrono's like never really like jumped to the forefront of the conversation with them for some reason. I don't know why. You know, after the Heritage Chrono,
right?
But yeah, I don't know why they in my opinion they've yet to crack the Chrono nut.
I think the size scares a lot of people off. Is my perspective on it, at least. I mean, because the Heritage is one of the coolest watches in the Tudor catalog. I mean, the fact that it's still there, just sitting there, is kind of amazing to me. And I wonder if it's ripe for a revamp. But yeah, when you look at the way that they do some of the cases and the bracelets, sometimes when we're talking about a 41, 42 millimeter watch, the Tudors can feel quite large.
Yeah,
which was great with the Diver, but I wonder if the Chronograph sometimes feels even bigger.
You know, as I say to you guys often, like, you know, it's always great to frame everything like why it exists, why it shouldn't exist. Like, it shouldn't exist because thinner watches are just better. Like, we all know that. Like, it's just better to wear, etc. It does exist and make sense for Tudor because, of course, the big block chronographs historically, like this, they have a precedent for making larger dimension cases than Rolex. But imagine if they did a Black Bay Chrono in the case dimension of a Daytona or something close to it, you know, and like how great of a watch would that be?
Yeah, it'd be amazing.
It'd be great.
Yeah, I think I'm not even that much of a Chronograph guy. And if they decided to do something like the Chronograph Blue, the Heritage in, like a 39, BB 39 case, like kind of because the Chronographs now are largely Black Bay inspired.
Yeah,
I think there's a blending there to speak to for sure. You know, I guess we've already gotten into it, but any other thoughts on we can do some predictions. Obviously, from our position, we have access to know most of what is coming out on the 27th. Let's stick to things that we absolutely don't know, which would be Patek, Tudor, and Rolex, I suppose.
Yep.
What do you think we might see, or what would you like to see? We could answer either question.
like you mentioned, James, we've been doing these like these Rolex Tudor prediction stuff.
Yeah, they should be up roughly around the same time as the episode, so it's maybe a teaser.
Yeah, and even if this spoils it a little bit, whatever. This is fine. I would like to see titanium make its way into the Daytona. That'd be really a cool thing. I doubt it. And even if it does happen, my prediction of what will happen is if it is titanium, it'll have the ice blue dial. That they'll just... They'll bring that in the fold.
Why would they put ice blue on titanium?
Because nobody wants that.
Okay.
that was my brief for making the thing that's not a prediction and not what I want is what would I not want and what would actually happen, and it's something like that. My actual prediction was a dial that nobody asked for. So it could be anything. It doesn't have to be ice blue, but a dial that nobody asked for.
I love that, like, the assumption now is that Rolex is going to, like, give you the case material you want in a dial that you hate, which is, like, exactly. Not that far from the truth. But, I mean, just historically, like, realistically, like, ice blue dial means platinum. So it would platinum, be odd, right, if they put it in titanium. But as you said, like, they do what they want to do.
Maybe meteorite.
Yeah, meteorite would be interesting. You're probably right that something like that, even meteorite, is relegated to something in a precious metal. And I honestly feel like the Deep Sea that came out a couple months ago is probably just a teaser for something that'll happen 5 to 10 years from now and not anything that's going to happen, you know, in the near term. But, you know, one can dream.
I would agree, honestly. I would agree. I mean, I don't know anything truly. I would agree that, you know, titanium seems like the next step. But weirdly, like, for me, I own several titanium watches, but, like, I don't think it's a particularly great material for watches. Like, steel, it's more expensive, it's more scratch resistant, whatever, lighter. But, like, steel's a great material. And steel to me is Rolex. And it also, like, at this point, I either want it's like a stainless steel watch I can wear all the time that's, like, priced appropriately, or I want to feel the weight of a gold or precious metal, platinum, whatever. Titanium is so light, it almost is jarring to a degree. And, like, for, like, the part of the charm of Rolex is, like, you feel it. And, like, the tactile nature of a Rolex, like, the build quality is just extraordinary. I don't know that titanium is the metal for me for Rolex. I think, you know, an AP or something that's like a little bit more, it's just a different feel, a different vibe. I'm totally on board, or an IWC or Porsche design or something technical. But yeah, I don't know that I would get super excited by a titanium Rolex. I say that now and give me 2 weeks and I'll be like, you know, screaming from the rooftop about how amazing it is. That would be, I don't want to say disappointment, but that wouldn't get me super excited this year.
Yeah, James, you saw the Deep Sea and wore it. What does it feel like? This is really what I want to know.
I mean, it feels like a huge it feels like a huge. There's no, like, because there's a visual element to it's so big, it has its own, like, zip code on your wrist. It's lighter than your brain tells you, but it also, your brain tells you it should weigh more than a platinum Daytona.
Right.
You know, it should be a half a pound of watch, and it's less than that. I think in the right scenario, you know, that being with a 7mm wetsuit, perfectly wearable for sure. But I would need to add a significant amount of padding to my wrist for it to make sense. But also, that's not, you know, the point of that watch wasn't wearability. And I think the deeper, every time you find a new, or every time I personally find a new layer of what they went through to make a watch that they're only going to make a few of, it's the most Rolex stuff ever. Is this watch, despite the fact that, like, the core of the brand, sure, is a Submariner, is a Day-Date, is a Datejust, stuff like that, but the like charm, the appeal is part of this is the secrecy, and part of this is the ability that they can make a watch like this. There's only a few brands out there that could that would bother and still have an audience for it. Mm-hmm. And I think they're the ones that have the most natural audience. A very impressive watch that doesn't need to be on my wrist, but I do think that it's a suggestion that we might see more titanium or RLX from the brand.
Yeah.
Whether that's a brand new watch or something more like, you know, in my mind, we haven't had a 40mm, and this was in my prediction, but like we haven't had a 40mm Sea Dweller in a while. And I don't think we'll see it this year, which is why it makes a good prediction post. But I do think at some point there might be essentially an everyday version of the Deep Sea Challenge. Mm-hmm.
That'd be pretty. I mean, now that we have a two-tone Explorer, I mean, I want to throw gold back in the mix. If we're throwing predictions out there, sure. Full gold, I'd actually buy it. But to your point, something that interests me about Rolex, and I've had conversations about this, is the fact that some of the watches that Rolex puts out there are limited in some fashion that's not stated. Like, they don't intend to produce them forever from the moment they release them, but they'll never tell. Yeah, they'll never tell you that.
Like the Stella. Like,
exactly. So the intention was never to have those run, and when they were quote unquote discontinued, that was always the plan from before it was released.
Do you know that?
And I find that to be, I do know that.
They told you that the plan was to always just have it run for a short period of time.
For some of those colors, yeah. Which I found to be pretty fascinating.
Yeah, so like a man or a woman in Switzerland told you that. Not necessarily employed by Rolex, but somebody in Switzerland told you that.
Someone in Switzerland told me that, yeah. Correct. A man or a woman.
So outside of Rolex, we talked about the arc of Tudor. What do you think we might see from Tudor? Obviously, last year, from a show standpoint, the big one was the BB Pro. And then later in the season, it was the Pelagos 39. Do you guys have anything you'd love to see? Anything you think is like a hole in the lineup, or even just what you think they might actually, launch?
I think that they're probably going to do something that's not super exciting, in the sense that I think we're going to get chronometer grade Black Bay 36-41 stuff. You know, they're still using the ETA based movements there. Mm-hmm. I'm not one. I really, making the splashy predictions is tough because they never come true. So I think something like that, which is a mechanical upgrade, seems like it's on the horizon.
Yeah, makes sense. So that would be something like a manufacturer movement, yeah, that's smaller.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think you always have to consider that Rolex and Tudor are literally the same company. Like the product committee is making the decision on both brands at the same time. And I'm curious if, presuming, and again, this is total presumption, presuming that Rolex has a big year, maybe Tudor has a lighter year, you know, so that they can put the shine on the big boy, and then next year the little brother comes up and does some crazy stuff. But that would be my assumption, but I don't know at all.
Yeah, my feeling is very similar, in that Tudor's had a lot of shine the last couple of years, and especially last year in total of the 12 months. And the other thing that, in keeping in step with your idea, with your assertion that Rolex and Tudor are the same company, I think that if we got a Pelagos 39, we're going to see a Pelagos in the other direction. Hmm. So we have the core Pelagos, but now we've got the Ultra Deep, and we've got the Deep Sea Challenge, and we've got a Bathyscaphe Tech. I think that there is a market for an even wilder, like Apex Predator dive watch from Tudor.
Yeah.
That would be less about its wearability, which is what the 39 is great for, and more about the Pelagos is still the Pelagos.
Yeah. I think now that you say that, I could see that. And I think, like, you know, to be clear, like the brands that have each other within their eye, like within their, you know, kind of like scope, so to speak, would be for Rolex and Tudor, it's Omega, obviously. And I think the idea of, like, yep, surrounding Omega, so to speak, from a technical perspective, I think would be interesting for Rolex. I can say that. And likewise, I mean, Omega has hit back resoundingly strongly over the last few years as well from a technical perspective. So I could see, now that you mentioned that, James, I agree with that.
Well, and think about the technical chops that we leave on the table. They developed with Comex a brand new machine to be able to test the Deep Sea Challenge. So let's say they wanted to put a Pelagos, not quite as deep, but somewhere close, somewhere in advance of, hypothetically, beyond 3,900 meters of a standard deep sea, that requires the machine that they made last year. There's some technical attributes that would lead them to create a watch that could be the new kind of big old flagship for Tudor dive watches that the Pelagos was for the last 10 years. And I think they gave us the 39, and we might see the, like, nerd tech diver extension beyond that this year. That's my only guess. That, you know, the one we put in the predictions, which is a more of a wish, was again that 39 millimeter take on the Heritage Chrono.
I also, you know, to Ben's point and yours, that it might be a sort of a less of a splashy release for Tudor, also goes to the fact that they have turned themselves into a 365 day a year release brand. And I feel like we've seen it now. Like, last year, I don't know how many releases there were, but it was like every 3 or 4 months there was a new Tudor.
Yep. And I mean, the P39 and the year before it, the Pelagos, both came out in the fall on their own schedule.
But a lot of brands have become like that, right? But I guess the question is that because Watches and Wonders wasn't happening? Or was it because, like, they just want to share, they want their own moment in the sun? I think it's probably a little bit of both. AP for sure. Like AP wants to have their own moment, and they just, and frankly, they deserve their own moment. But I'd be curious to see if like, if that, now that Watches and Wonders presumably is back in full force, like, will they hold stuff for later in the year? I know some brands certainly are, but at the same time also, like, you get one chance to show, like, we should say also, like, the primary, to be clear, the primary function of Watches and Wonders is to show retailers these products. And the retailer would say, hey, Rolex Tudor, I want a million of these and 100 of those and none of these, you know? So I just think, you know, if you have the chance of having all your retailers under one roof for a week, they're going to show as much as possible. But there have been experiences or moments where, like, the retailers get to see something and, like, press does not. It's not officially out yet, but people get to see it.
Oh, for sure.
But who knows? It's anybody's guess, sincerely.
Yeah, and I wonder, too, because Omega has shifted away from, last year they did Omega Days, and this year they're not. And my understanding from that perspective is they're going to be releasing different products on their own at different moments in the year. And I wonder if Tudor and Omega are operating, they're operating at similar price points in a lot of areas. If there's almost a direct competition there, that they don't want to miss each other as the year goes on too.
I think that whatever one major player does, it reflects over the next couple of years in terms of what others do. Obviously, if you remember when the Submariner went to the 41 millimeter,
right,
that was a September release for that year. Because there wasn't a trade show and nobody else, there wasn't a Tudor that September, unless I'm forgetting something crazy. But I think they kind of operated on their own, you know, with embargoes, the whole thing, kind of a different move than Rolex commonly does. And that was for a major watch.
Like the watch, right? And the Submariner is the watch.
Yeah.
That was the colorful OP year, wasn't it, James? It was the same release as the colorful OPs, because I remember Rolex had stated after COVID, after the pandemic and the whole shutdown, that they weren't going to have any releases that year. And then suddenly in the fall, it was, no, we are. And then there was a whole string. It was some new Sky Dwellers, some Submariner, and then the OP stuff.
Well, we've got a few minutes left. Let's close on Patek. I don't think I would have predicted what came out last year, certainly, even if I had sat and kind of thought about the idea of essentially like Patek's take on a field watch. Those watches have really grown on me in the last year.
Yeah,
I just think they're like wildly cool things.
Did you see the one at our meetup a few weeks ago?
No.
It was in the photo report.
Which was it, in the annual or the three-hand?
Three-hander. Really, that was actually, I think, the first or second, I guess the second time I've seen it in the metal, but kind of weirdly compelling. Like, really like, oh, okay, like, all right, I get this, you know? And like, do I want it? I don't even know. But, you know, much more so than I thought that I would. Yeah, Patek. Like, I think, like, we have a 5811, which almost nobody talks about because there's basically like zero in the market and it's white gold. You know, is there going to be a 5811 steel? I mean, might make sense, you know, but who knows? I mean, my guess is they're going to do a bunch of, like, you know, moderately complicated watches like annual chronographs and chronos, et cetera, with some new dials, et cetera. But I don't have any major prediction because, again, like, I'm just, the market has changed so much and all this stuff is going to trade at retail so fast that it's like they almost don't even want to communicate about it for Patek in particular, because like it just means you're going to be pissing people off more. So, you know, like the annual calendar chronograph and steel with the salmon dial, like that was in stores basically the day that it was communicated and they were all already sold. So it's like, I don't know that like the sequencing of communication, marketing, effectively retail, and then sales exists anymore, so it's hard to say.
Yeah, are they spoken for at retail to buyers that they just know will buy any new, like they're on the top of the list for anything that seems desirable? Because there's no way that someone could communicate to the retailer that they know it's coming. I'm just curious from you.
I mean, it historically how it works from with myself and other people that are far bigger buyers than I is like, you get a text message of like a link to Hodinkee or a link to Patek.com saying, hey, want it?
Yeah.
And the answer is always yes. And then like sometimes it's not yes, and that's okay too. And it's not like, you know, it's not like everything goes to the same three guys or gals or whatever. Like they do spread it around. But Patek dealers are masters at like placing the watches with the people that will excite them in the right way so that they come back to buy something else. And if you've got Aquanauts and Nautiluses, you don't need help selling those at all. But there's a very real possibility that in 6 months, a year, whatever, you know, who knows, that anything but those watches will not be easy sales. And I think I've heard anecdotally from Patek authorized dealers, AP dealers, that the market has changed a lot over the past 6 months, where like any Royal Oak historically was like an insta buy. Like you just buy it. Doesn't matter what it is. Like don't even ask questions. Now I've heard of people passing on steel perpetual calendars, you know, which like 6 months ago was unheard of. And the retail price of that has gone up. The market price has come down. All of a sudden that delta isn't so crazy. Because before you were buying it because like, holy shit, I can make 100% profit if I sell this thing, which you can't, of course, if you want to remain in their good graces. But that delta has changed markedly over the past few months. So I think things are good. Like retail sales, I actually ran into an AP retailer last night. And he said things have changed a lot. And, you know, to be clear, things are still moving very fast. But I think the world of like insta-buy for any Patek or any AP is short-lived, I think.
Well, look, Ben, the last time that we sat down and did one of these recordings together was actually in my hotel room in L.A. back in end of October, early November during the Omega event.
Yeah, I got a lot of DMs being like, what's it like to be in James's hotel room?
Just tidy, I hope. It was also a hotel room larger than some condos I've owned, so I have a lot of space to cordon my you know messy laundry somewhere else. But we did sit and chat about some of the Patek releases at the time, including the 5935A, which is their steel salmon dial, world timer. And I saw that on your Instagram recently. Did you get a chance to see that one in person?
Yeah, I've got two or three friends that have it, and I was down in Austin, Texas over the weekend at South by Southwest, and a friend down there has it, and he's a very active buyer, and his authorized dealer gave him the first one, and it I have to say pretty cool. Like it is a really really cool thing that,
yeah,
you know, the kind of hatchwork dial I wasn't super sold on until I saw it. It's really very very cool, and I see the appeal, and that's a watch that I could see myself wearing definitely. You know, they've really adopted, Patek has done a really good job adopting a lot of the stuff that was really popular in like the vintage Patek and vintage watch world. Frankly, a lot of their straps look like Hodinkee straps that we were designing, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Not at all taking credit, to be clear. But like those kind of suede-y, nubucky, you know, like light tan, almost camel-y straps, like those were prevalent in the vintage Patek and Rolex world for many, many years. And now we're seeing it on production watches. I actually have the day that I got my 5270, I actually asked Patek for a military style strap from off their pilot's watch to put it on that watch. And like now we're seeing those straps come production on some of these things. It's a really cool watch. And I, you know, that would be one that would be compelling to me in the modern catalog. That's outside the Nautilus Aquanaut stuff. And I still think like, again, I love Nautiluses. I love Aquanauts. You know, I've had them. But Patek to me is still like, it's a dress watch company. And it's like, that's like, yeah, like when you're crushing it and like, you know, you're a banker or something like that, like you wear a 5970, you drive a 911 turbo or whatever, like that is a vibe, you know? And of course, like that has changed markedly now where it's like, you're just like a Silicon Valley dude or an entrepreneur and like you're wearing shirts and a t-shirt and you still wear a 5970 or 5270. But I think, you know, Patek does so much more than the Aquanaut and Nautilus. It really, I've said this 1,000 times, I'll say it one more time. It's a shame that people are so focused on just the sports watches when there's just so much else out there. Historically, even like a 5905 or 5205, like annual calendars, 5170s, 5270s, 5172 is a great watch. The perpetuals are great. There's just so much there. And it's all done to such a high level that it's just, again, a bummer from like my perspective as a watch nerd to see people care only about the sports watch.
That's fair. I got really pumped for that 59th. I can't wait. Maybe they'll have one. I'm sure they'll have one in the vitrines at Basel. Maybe I can convince them to bring one out during our meeting.
Yeah, and if not, like you will run into somebody you know that is wearing it. Like there's just no question you don't. It might be Danny Milton.
He's got that Watches in the Wild money now.
Those Watches in the Wild residuals keep coming in.
That's right.
Bing. All right, guys. I think we should leave the rest of whatever might be on our mind for episodes that we'll record in various stages of caffeination and lack of caffeination in Geneva in 10, 12 days from now. It's going to be great.
Yeah, soon, man.
So soon.
And if you're listening and enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. Please know that we're going to have a daily, call it 30-minute to 60-minute episode. So if you want in on the chit-chat from the show, that'll be the best way to do it. And be sure to subscribe so that it just shows up in your feed. But as always, thank you so much for listening, and we'll chat to you in a little more than a week's time, and then a whole bunch back-to-back.
Thanks, James.
See you guys.